I said, I'm Chuck C., and I'm an alcoholic. I'm neither proud of it, nor am I ashamed of it. That's the way it is with me. I am an alcoholic. This is one of the easiest things I say. I'm an alcoholic. But until something happened to me, I couldn't say that. Not even to myself. This was something nobody must know, not even me. And I went to any length to keep anybody from knowing it, including myself. So something has to happen before we can say I'm an alcoholic. If any one of you had called me an alcoholic 30 years ago, and I could have gotten up off the floor, I'd have kicked you right in the mouth if I could have seen you. But something happened to me in January 1946. And I could say I'm an alcoholic. And I haven't had to have a drink or pill since. Something over 9,500 days without a drink or pill. By the grace of God, through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'm one who believes that something has to happen to you and to me before we can fulfill the conditions for sobriety. One of two things has to happen, I think. Either we have to drink the last dregs out of the bottom of the cup, and that's the way it happened to me, or we have to come to see that there's nothing ahead of us but permanent insanity or an alcoholic death. Or we will not do the things necessary to obtain and maintain sobriety. We can't do them. We're a peculiar breed of cats. We can't hear till we can hear, and we can't see till we can see. Now let's look at that for half a minute. People come to this program who can't hear, I mean physically can't hear, and get sober and stay sober. We had an old boy out in San Diego that came to this program for 17 years or so and died sober, and he couldn't hear a thing. People come to this program that can't understand the language. And they get sober and stay sober. We got an old boy up in Santa Barbara. He happens to be Mexican. He came to the program, a Mexican wino, with 13 kids. So he wasn't drunk all the time. And he couldn't even understand English. But he got sober and stayed sober. Right off the bat, he got sober and stayed sober. I talked at his 10th birthday. He's now past 20 years. And he got up there and he says, I'm better educated than your speaker. He says, I can speak two languages and he can only speak one. Because he had gone back to school. And he'd graduated from high school. After coming to the program and getting sober and already having 13 kids. So, he heard without hearing and did and stayed sober. People come to the program that physically cannot see and they get sober and stay sober. Somebody told me down in Louisiana the other day, I was down there eating crawdads. And they had several hundred people at the meeting. And they told me that 30%, 33% of the people in that group could neither read nor write. I didn't think there would be an audience in the United States where 30%. 33% couldn't read or write. But that's what you told me about this gun. And there were only a half a dozen blacks in the whole crowd. These were white folks. And they could neither read nor write. And it's one of the real great AA weekends. They were talking and living, the best AA you ever saw. So, many of us, you and me, cannot hear and cannot see, although we have ears and eyes. For instance, until I had run out of time, people, places, things, health, sanity, and choice, I couldn't even come to this program. I couldn't even investigate it. As long as I had choice, my choice was never to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never came, as long as I had the power of choice. So those of you who still have choice, don't be discouraged. There's a line in our book that says that. Don't be discouraged, but I don't think it means just what I'm about to say. I'm telling you to don't be discouraged. Keep on nipping that flit, and the time will come when you ain't got no choice. This will be the only place left that you can go. And it's surprising how easy it is to come here when there's no place else to go. Now, again, just for fun. 3 months before I came calling into this program, on my next to the last trip, I made a 6,000-mile journey, automobile trip, in a blackout. I don't recommend it. I drove from Beverly Hills, California, to Louisville, Kentucky, to North Michigan, and back to the coast. And I don't remember 5% of it. The 5% of it that I remember is very interesting, but I'm not going to tell you. Because I ain't got time. But I eventually got back to the coast, and I went to bed to finish my drunk. I finished all of my drunks in bed the last 10 years. And I never got out of bed for any other purpose than to replenish my supply. And I can tell you, good people, that there are other reasons to get out of bed. I never quit while I could get another supply. But when the time came that I was out of liquor and out of strength, and Mrs. C'd have to lift my head off the pillow, put a little liquid in my mouth, I couldn't even roll over to see if there's a bottle under the bed, I would have to quit, and that time came. And maybe 24, 36 hours after my last drink, I was able to go to the kitchen for a glass of buttermilk, which I did. Mrs. C and Dick were sitting in the living room. They heard me let out a yell, and they heard me hit the floor. And they came trotting out, they tell me, expecting to find me in an alcoholic convulsion, which was my want. But I'd done run out of convulsions. I wasn't convulsing. I was just lying there on the kitchen floor as peaceful as anybody ever saw. I wasn't doing nothing. They tell me I was a very peculiar color. I was blue. And they couldn't wake me up. Now, as serious as this thing is, it just tickled the hell out of me. Because I'm mindful of the many, many times I came off a drunk in those last 10 years, to find that everybody in town was looking for me. 90% of them just to tell me they never wanted to see me again. Now, why do they have to ferret us out, you know, to tell us they never want to see us again, I don't know. But they do. They always do. And my wife and kids had been praying for me to die for not less than 5 years. And they come to the kitchen and find me dead. And they get all exercised about it, you see? And they call the oxygen squad from the Beverly Hills Receiving Hospital. And they came down and worked me over. And I think they woke me up. I think they did. And I remember what happened after I came to. There was a young doctor with him. And he was telling me what had happened. And he told me that, to all intents and purposes, I'd been dead. That they'd had a rough time bringing me back. And it was their opinion that nobody would ever be able to bring me back again under those circumstances. And he very seriously told me that if he were me, he wouldn't do that anymore. I got the impression that they were against it. Well, it's another 24 or 36 hours, and I've gotten well enough to get the old dirty bathrobe on and start walking off this drunk. That's the only way I ever knew how to sober up. I never heard of a drying out place. And then I came to my first meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've never had to use it because I've never had to sober up since my first meeting. The only way I knew to sober up was to die until I could live. And I mainly did it walking. Sweating, freezing, shaking, dying, and walking. And that's what I'm doing. Living room, up and down the living room. We had a corner fireplace. Mrs. C was standing over the fireplace. And I'm walking away from her. And she says, "Chuck, don't you think you might get a little help if you'd read the book Alcoholics Anonymous?" And she might as well have hit me over the head with a ball bat. I turned on her like a lion. I said, "You, my very own wife, suggesting that I read a book written by a bunch of drunks." "I have read all the good books for the good authors. And you want me, why?" I says, "You wound me deeply." I'd been dead, just been dead 48 hours before. And she wounds me deeply. And I polished her off completely by saying, "And besides, I can write a better book than that myself." Now, mind you, I'd been drinking 25 years. And this was just 90 days before I came crawling in here. This is what I'm talking about. There was no way under heaven that I could get any help because I could not hear and I could not see. So something has to happen to us before we can get any help. And those of us who are working with alcoholics must see this, or they'll kill us. They'll kill us if we don't see this. We've got to give them the right to make their own mistakes. I'm one who believes that it is not within my scope to deny the alcoholic his right to suffer. Because something's got to happen. And with some of us, the only way it can happen is by suffering. You get an alcoholic that might be just about ready to go to headquarters for a little help. And give him a $20 bill, and he ain't got no problems anymore. His problems are solved. Till the 20's gone. We got to recognize the need for help before we can get it. And that's why in our third chapter in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. To fully concede to our innermost selves. Now, why should this be the first condition for sobriety? And be way back there in chapter 3. 12 steps are in chapter 5, the program of recovery. And this is back in chapter 3. Why? Because you and I, if we be alcoholic, are caught in a trap we cannot spring. We have to have help. And we can't get it until we recognize the need for it. To accept ourselves exactly as we are, where we are right now, is the first condition of recovery. For instance, again, I drank for 25 years. And up until my last drunk to date, it was never my fault that I drank. Never. It was your fault. If you stupid people had lived like I knew you should and like I told you how, I wouldn't have had to drink. But you wouldn't do it, so I got drunk at you. I had a perfectly legitimate reason for every drunk I was ever on till my last one. My wife, many of you know her. She was a good excuse. Reason, I mean, not excuse. And while she was very good as an excuse, her mother was much better. Now, there was a king-size excuse to drink. She had only one kid, and I was married to her. And she was living with us. And she had a grandstand seat watching me crucify her only daughter. And she didn't like me very good. And I didn't like her that good. She hadn't been living with us, I wouldn't have had to crucify her daughter. We had a mutual hating society that was a beautiful thing to behold. But I have to tell you that she lived with us 5 years after I got sober. And it is absolutely amazing what this program did for her. They should have come through that same living room in the last year she lived and found me slapping that daughter of hers all over the living room. She'd have said, "Why, Elsa, what have you done?" By this time, I could do no wrong. My boss was a fantastic reason for me to get drunk. It was obvious to me that I had all the brains in the organization. And he had all the money. And the very injustice of the situation. Make anybody get drunk. So up until my last drunk, it was never my fault. My last drunk, I came to see that if there be fault, it's mine. And I've never had to drink anymore. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. God can't even help us until we will allow him to. So, that last excuse has got to go to the boards. One of our beloved guys in this area went home before this meeting. He knew I was going to talk. So he beat it back to Dallas. And he tells a story that tickles me. He says that these two drunks met on the street. And one of them says the other, "How stinks?" And he says, "Not good." Well, he says, "That's bad." Or he says, "Not so bad, I got married." Well, he says, "That's good." He says, "Not so good, I got my mother-in-law, too." But he says, "That's bad." He says, "Not so bad, she's got money." He says, "That's good." He says, "Not so good, she wants to boss everything." Well, he says, that's bad. He says, "Not so bad, since she bought us a house." Well, he says, "That sure is good." He says, "Not so good, brother, since the house burned down." But he says, "That sure is bad." He says, "Not bad, she burned, too." I'll write that down for you, Steve. Now, that last excuse has got to burn up. It's got to go. If you and I have one excuse left that is still acceptable to us, we have another drunk left. Because no man is going to do the things necessary to bring about sobriety as long as he can pin this deal on anything else at all. So the first condition for sobriety is to accept ourselves as we are where we are. Now, the second is that sobriety must come first. Sobriety must come first. And this is awful hard for us to see, and it's much harder for our mates to see, those around us. The non-alcoholic who's lived with us, mine for 20 years. True, she was getting rid of me legally 26 years ago. But she'd lived with me for 20 years. And I come to this program. And I'm fairly busy after I get here. Because I came often and stayed late. Because I wanted this thing more than life. And after 6 months of a meeting every night, with the great fear upon me that I couldn't have this thing, I woke up to the fact that I was sober and had been for 6 months. All the time, I'd been sober. And it was quite a discovery. And it was then I started talking. And I haven't shut up yet. And amongst those to whom I talked was my wife. Now, I hadn't told her anything about this program at all. Matter of fact, I hadn't told her anything. We weren't communicating to a third party, you know. But I had to talk, and I talked to her about this program. And I found that she'd already read my book about three or four times. And she asked me to take her to meetings. And I did. And she's still going with me. But anyway, maybe it's 4 months later. I may have been 10, 11 months in the program. And I was asked to do a 10-minute talk before the regular speaker in the Beverly Hills group. That was my home group. And I did. And I ended the little talk by saying, if it were necessary for me tonight to go to Tibet to maintain what I found here, I would go home, pack my little grip, come through the living room, kiss my wife, and say, honey, it's too bad, I've got to go. Now, I didn't think that was bad. Until about 30 minutes after we got home. And I'm sitting there, and I feel the old house start rocking. And I look over, and my wife is almost in convulsions. She's just crying her eyes out. And I said, well, honey, what's the matter? She says, oh, what you said. She says, for the first time in 20 years, we have a chance to have a little peace and joy and happiness in this household. And you'd go to Tibet. She says, don't I mean anything to you? Don't the children mean anything to you? Don't the home mean anything to you? Boo-hoo. And I let her cry until she calmed down a little. And I says, honey, do I mean anything to you drunk? And she says, no. Do I mean anything to the kids drunk? No. Anything to the home drunk? She says, no. Do I mean anything to me drunk? And she says, no. And I said, well, can't you see this has to come first? And she couldn't. That is not easy. But the wonder of this thing lies right here. When you're willing to go, you don't have to. It's becoming willing that's the deal. Now, I've been willing to go to Tibet to maintain this thing for 26 years and 3 months. And I never even had to go to Watts. it's awful hard to see. Now, there's a little verse, and I shouldn't quote verses, but I do. And it's not because I want to prove to you how many verses I know, but because verses, in so many instances, say what I want to say better than I can say it. I got a doctor at home who looks at me and he says, I hate people that quote verses. I said, hate me, brother. There's a little verse that says, lest a man be willing to leave his mother and his father and his wife and his kids, sell all he has and give it to the poor, and take up his cross and follow me. He's not worthy of me. Now, for the 30 years prior to the time I came to this program, I would have argued with the Pope in Rome and the entire College of Cardinals that the carpenter didn't say that. I knew he didn't. Because he was a good man. He couldn't have said that. I was an evil man, and I couldn't say it, so I knew he couldn't. What cad is going to leave his wife and his kids, and you know? So I knew he didn't say it. It was either a deliberate attempt to deceive or a mistranslation. But I wasn't sober more than 5 years anyway, when I knew that if he didn't say it, he should have. Because all in the world that means is that my own peace of mind and serenity of purpose cannot depend on any person, place, thing, circumstance, or condition out there. It depends only on my own relationship with my very own God. Thou shalt have no other God before me. Now that's all in the world, that means. So, it's hard to come to see that sobriety must come first. But I am one who believes that unless and or until it comes first, we can't have it. And unless it remains first, we cannot keep it. Because otherwise we will not do the things that are necessary to obtain and maintain sobriety. Because they're absolutely a reversal of our thought and action pattern in our entire life up until the time we come here. It is just exactly like I'd walked straight north for 43 years, made a 180-degree turn, and walked south for 26. That's the difference in life. And you can't do it. We alcoholics can't do it unless we have it done for us, as I did, or come to see that there's nothing ahead of us but permanent insanity or an alcoholic death. Now, fortunately for me, I never had to surrender consciously the first time. And I say fortunately for me because I couldn't have done it. There was no way that I could surrender. No way. The word was not even in my vocabulary. So the first time, the bottle did it for me. It killed me. It beat me and total and absolute nothingness. And I came to the program surrendered. Thank God. Now, I've had to surrender many, many times since, consciously. But the first time it's done for me. And when I got here, everything in Chapter 5 was something I wanted to do. Everything was something I wanted to do. And I know that it was because of the total state of abandonment of self in which I got here. Now, to make it a little simple, because we, I believe, make it awful hard on ourselves, to make it a little simple, I did not abandon myself to God. I did not abandon myself to this simple program. I did not know this simple program. I had made it my business not to know anything about it. And I couldn't abandon myself to God because I didn't think it was cricket even to believe that I could give this mess, that was made to anybody, much less to God. So I abandoned myself to nothing, which is the same thing. All we need is to abandon ourselves, and the roadblock is gone. So, when I got the program, the one thing that I couldn't do was take step three. All the rest of them were pretty nice. But step three I couldn't do, not because I didn't want to. I would have turned my will and my life over to a jackass if I could have gotten rid of me, you know. But I wouldn't have taken me with a large dowry. And I didn't figure God would either. So I just let that lay. And I took off with the last third of 12 when the time came. Practiced these principles in all of our affairs. And later on discovered the fact that I already had taken the third step before I got here. I had completely abandoned myself to nothing. Now, I wanted this morning to give you the United States version of the 12 steps. That Canadian honker got up here and goofed them all up the other night. And I thought I should straighten you out. But I'm not going to do it. I'm going to just talk a little bit around it and then talk about something else. You know, the first step in the program is a twofold admission of defeat. Now, that's why these other two things have to come before the step number one. That sobriety comes first and that we accept ourselves as we are. Because otherwise, we could not take that first step. It's a twofold admission of defeat. I'm powerless over alcohol, physical. My life's unmanageable, mental. I've lost the battle of life twice over. Now, that's not easy for an alkie, you know. You're not just going to run into the bar and say, look, Joe, I'm powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanageable. Give me a double. Quick. You're not going to do that. By this time, you've got to go in and start building an image for that bartender. You got to tell him about your good fortune. You just made a big merger. Sold a railroad, you know. Built him all up because after the fourth drink, you've got to discover you forgot your pocketbook. So you're certainly not going to admit to him that you've lost the battle of life. But that's where we start. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. A twofold admission of defeat. The second one, a left-handed admission that we're nutty as a fruitcake. First step, we've lost the battle. Second step, we're insane. Now, that's pretty fast going for a drunk, isn't it? Huh? Right off the bat. Lost the battle of life and nuts. Second step says we came to believe that far greater results could restore us to sanity. Now, there's an implication here. You don't have to restore a sane person to sanity, you know. It's not necessary. So if we need to be restored to sanity, we're nuts. And that's only the second. Third one's worse than both of them. Because the third one says you got to turn over the keys. You got to turn over the keys. Now, there's only one way that anybody ever devised to get my keys. That was to wait till I passed out. I could come out of a pub at 3 o'clock in the morning with my wife or yours. and we'd head for the parking lot. And she'd say, honey, give me the keys, I'll drive. You'd say, whose car? This is my car. If you're going with me, get in. I'm driving. Now, you might be there till daylight. You ain't gone to no place. But you've still got the keys. Step number three says you got to get a new driver. We made a decision to turn our will and lives over to the care of God. Now, this is not alcoholic thinking. Just the reverse. And, of course, something has to happen before we can do it. This is the reason we talk a little bit about our problem, as it's known to, say, medical science. When I came to my first meeting, I came alone. I never had a sponsor. The meeting was on the ground floor. I disguised myself as much as I could because I didn't think that it might be a good thing to be seen going into places that are occupied by people like you. So I put on the two good garments that I had. Camel's hair, gray camel's hair coat with a belt around the middle and a big collar. And I pulled that collar up around my head. And I had a hat with a very wide brim on it. Most of you have seen it for years. I still wear it in cold weather. And I put that hat on and I pulled that thing down over my face and sallied forth. And I got there about maybe 10 minutes before the meeting started. And I stood in the doorway and I looked at you. And with my keen alcoholic mind, it didn't take me very long to see that they'd given me the wrong information. Because there were about 40 people in there. And they didn't look like me and they weren't dressed like me. And they most certainly didn't feel like me. Because they're all standing in there in the middle of the room yakking. Yak, 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 yak. Nobody listening. Everybody talking. And, of course, I knew that these were the veterans and their wives, and they were there for a party. Because this was veterans of Foreign Wars Hall. They'd given me the wrong information and like to kill me. Because at long last, I'd come. And it was the wrong night. And I was a living dead man for sure when I turned to leave. Now, this is the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous in the next minute. This is it. Without this, no recoveries at all. None. Somebody inside had been watching. And when I started to leave, he ran over the door. And he called to me. And he says, Mister, were you looking for somebody? And I said, no, sir. Well, he says, what were you looking for? And I said, it was interesting, sir. I was looking for a sobriety because I thought he was better. And with that, he lit up like a Christmas tree. And I was hooked before he ever opened his mouth again. You see, it was obvious that this guy was glad I was there. And I was no bargain. I just come off of a 4 weeks blackout, drunk. And to this guy, I was really a bargain. He lit up like a Christmas tree. And when he opened his mouth, he says, why, take off your hat and coat, you're in the right place. Now, this is a miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous right now. He took me in and rocked me to sleep. Without this, no recoveries. This is the reason this thing works when nothing else in the world does. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope one with another. Sharing, caring and sharing is Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what they did. And they took me in there and they told me a few things that I've never forgotten. They told me that if I were an alcoholic, one drink was too many and 1,000 weren't enough. They said it's first drink that's killing you. Now, I'd only drunk 25 years, so that's not very long. But nobody had ever told me it was the first drink that's killing me. Nobody. No doctor, priest, preacher, psychiatrist had ever told me it's the first drink that's killing me. And I'd never told myself, because I was periodic for the last 10 years. And periodics don't get drunk in a hurry. There's no way that we could figure out that it was the first drink. Periodics taper on. They never taper off. Now, for my last 10 years, my job was not the first drink. It was the last gallon. What I was trying to do was find a way to cut it off before the trouble started, you know? And I got here, and these monkeys says it's the first drink. It's killing you. And I played with it a while and bought it, because I could see it was just a question of time from that first slug after a dry spell. And I was physically as sober as them tonight between every two drunks for 10 years, the last 10. It was just a question of time from that first slug till I was flat on my back drinking the clock around again. So I bought it. The second thing they told me, and this is a sneaky way to keep you coming back, the second thing they said was, today is the day we don't drink. Isn't that something? Today is the day we don't drink. Now, they'd have told me I had to be sober 26 years or drop dead. Hell, nobody ever stayed sober 26 years. 26 days was without, there was no reason that could even settle for 26 days. But they didn't say that. They said, today is the day we don't drink. Now, if a day is too long, how about an hour? How long can you live without a drink? Put your life on that basis. Live that long and don't drink and start over. But, said they, no matter how many years you live in Alcoholics Anonymous, you will not change that time to include more than 24 hours. One day at a time. It's as long as you live. About that. And I've lived it that way for 26 years. I never worked for birthday. I never worked for next Tuesday. Today is my day. I have no past. I want no future. Surprising how easy life is when you do it one day at a time. Now, of course, in the beginning, it was for sobriety only. But by the time I woke up the fact I was sober, I was used to doing it in everything I did. And it's been one day for everything since. And I highly recommend it. If there's one thing I wish that you might all take home with you, those of you who haven't done it, is that you leave every yesterday in this room when you go home. Leave every yesterday that you ever lived in this room when you go, when you leave. And every tomorrow. Because the combined intelligence of the human race can't change one thought or act of yesterday. And tomorrow isn't even ours. God's. 99% of our trouble is yesterday's burdens and tomorrow's fears. And when you haven't got either one of them, you're home free. Fantastic. Now, the next thing they told me is stay close to us. Get into as many meetings as you can, said they. And I bought that. Said they, there's more wisdom in this room about your problem and its answer than in any other room on the face of the earth, except another room just like this, where members of Alcoholics Anonymous are meeting. Get into as many meetings as you can. And I did. And I am. I've averaged near 5 and 4 meetings a week for 26 years. And I've never attended one too many. You know, you hardly ever see anybody get drunk in an AA meeting. Hardly ever. So, I'll be coming to these meetings till you pat me in the face with the scoop. Now, many of you might have heard me say this. It doesn't happen too long ago, but some of you pretty likely didn't. But I was talking to a guy that's about my age in this program not long ago. And he said to me, "Chuck," he says, "I'll quit working with wet drunks." He says, "I've done my part of that, and I'm tired of them puking on me." He says, "How about you?" I said to him, "Well, you do as you like. But I'm going to keep right on going, just like I am. Because I'd a hell of a lot rather be the pukee than the puker." And then he told me why I couldn't drink like other people. The reason I can't drink like other people is because I'm an alcoholic. What is an alcoholic? An alcoholic is a person who suffers with the disease of alcoholism. The disease of alcoholism. I've never heard that before in my life. Nobody had ever mentioned the disease of alcoholism to me until I came here. But I've remained with you to find that informed medical opinion classifies alcoholism as one of the top three killers in the country today. Some of them put it first. None of them put it more than fourth as a killer. It's second only to one of our social diseases, the cause for permanent insanity. And medically speaking, it's incurable. And that's what I got. I'm an alcoholic. It's a matter of life or death, and it's my life. Now, the definition that came to us through a doctor, by a doctor, defines the disease as a disease of a twofold nature, an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. It's both physical and mental, according to the doctor. The allergy of the body meaning simply this, that for some reason unknown to anybody, my body cannot successfully handle alcohol. I can't oxidize it, burn it up, and get rid of it. I take a slug of liquor, I retain it, it goes into the bloodstream and the brain. And it triggers a physical demand that makes me keep on drinking until my cycle is run. Now, this is not true with 90% of those who drink liquor, and this is one of our greatest problems. We look around us and see people that are obviously our inferiors, drinking that flip and not getting into any trouble, you know? And we say to ourselves, "Why can't I drink? He does, and he ain't got it." And our answer is, "I can, and I got to prove it." I'm still trying to prove it 10 years after I've lost the battle. And I went to many places where they should have been able to help me. But in those days, prior to 26 years ago, almost nobody knew anything about the disease of alcoholism. They talked to me about willpower, backbone, stand up being a man. You know? They didn't know, and they couldn't help me, and I didn't know, and I couldn't help myself. So it's a good thing to know why we can't successfully drink. Now, if you and I could tell each other if we continued to drink, we'd end up alcoholics. Maybe we'd believe each other. But that's not true. Now, experts tell me that every user of dope over a period of time becomes an addict. Every one of them, 100%. But that's not true with us. Only 10% of us end up alcoholics. And there's no self-respecting alcoholic on earth who's going to put himself in the bottom 10%. If we can't operate in the top 5, we won't play. One of our great problems. But it's an awful good thing to know. Now, there are a couple of things about the physical side of the disease that we know about.